Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, More Than Meets the Eye, we bring you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading prepared by Jill Bevilacqua. And Joan Knows, our resident Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, takes us back over the past week's events here in the Vatican. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
This is Vatican Radio. I'm Tracy McClure. We present Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Jesus told this parable to his disciples. A man was going on a journey. He called in his servants and handed his funds over to them according to each man's abilities. To one he disbursed 5,000 silver pieces, to a second 2,000, and a third 1,000. After a long absence, the master of those servants came home and settled accounts with them. The man who received the 5,000 came forward, bringing the additional 5. My lord, he said, you let me have 5,000. See, I have made 5,000 more.
Although the word doesn't appear in the version we've just heard, today's parable is commonly known as the parable of the talents. And it's not only the word used in most versions and most familiar to us, but it also has more significance, for it's what the parable is all about. To the English speaker of today, the word talent means what one modern dictionary defines it as, natural aptitude or skill. The second definition is given as a former weight and unit of currency used by the ancient Romans and Greeks. It's interesting to see, though, that another dictionary compiled at roughly the same time inverts the two meanings, giving precedence to the unit of weight and currency. And this, of course, is what our Lord's hearers would have understood. While originally the talent was a unit of weight for precious metals, gold and silver, it later represented the value of these metals and was used as a coin. At one time, its value was around 35 kilos of gold. The annual revenue of Herod the Great, we're told, was of 900 talents. 5 talents, or 5,000 silver pieces then, was a considerable sum. And even 2,000 or 2 talents was not to be sneezed at. And so the first 2 servants invest the money, and each doubles the amount received in trust. The third, who received 1,000 silver pieces, or 1 talent, digs a hole in the ground and buries the money. Coins and other valuables of gold and silver found in the ground are invariably described as treasure. And in 1635, the word talent was used figuratively for treasure or riches, while the stories of buried treasure are numberless and never seem to go out of fashion. Did it all come from our parable? Apparently not. It must have been a common custom, for another parable speaks of hidden treasure. Matthew again.
The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which someone has found. He hides it again, goes off happy, sells everything he owns, and buys the field.
And a scholar of today makes this comment.
Matthew seems to allude to the custom of the ancients of hiding their precious objects in the earth, placed with care in special containers, when invading enemy armies approached. Once the danger was over, it was easy enough to come across these hiding places and so make one's fortune, having once bought the field from its owner.
But what about those who bury money in the hopes that it will multiply? Carlo Collodi, in his celebrated story of Pinocchio, pointed the moral that money can only be earned honestly with the labour of hand or brain. The crafty fox and cat persuade Pinocchio to bury his 4 gold coins in the field of miracles. Water the ground, go away, and come back in 20 minutes, when he will find a little tree with its branches covered with money. And after counting the minutes, Pinocchio goes back, talking to himself of all the wonderful things he will buy with the money.
I shall have a magnificent palace, and 1,000 wooden ponies, and 1,000 stables to play with, and a cellar full of lollies and cordials, and a library brimful of candies and tarts and cakes and almond biscuits and cream puffs.
While he was thus talking to himself, he came near the field and stopped to look if he could see a tree with branches laden with money. But he saw nothing. He went a little nearer. Still nothing. He entered the field, went to the spot where he'd buried his gold pieces, and still nothing at all. He stood there, pondering.
And when the ghost of his conscience appears in the shape of a talking parrot and tells him that the fox and the cat have been back and dug up his money, Pinocchio is incredulous.
Pinocchio stood there with his mouth open, and as he did not believe what the parrot said, he began to dig up the earth he had watered. He dug and dug and dug until he had a big hole big enough for a haystack. But money, there was none.
The moral of our parable today is a different one, of course, and the experts explain.
We must always use and develop as much as possible the gifts that God has given us so that we may be ready to present them to him whenever he calls us. Failure to use God's gifts is considered a sin worthy of punishment.
The exact meaning of the word used, be it funds, talents, or gifts, is not easy to interpret. Was Jesus speaking of the gifts of mind and body, or of what St. Paul describes as the spiritual gifts? Our gifts differ according to the grace given us. Our scholars opt for the second. The reference to the Master returning after a long absence indicates the time in which we must know how to bring the divine gift to fruit.
While we await the coming of the Lord at the end of time, it is indispensable that we be hard-working. The gift of divine grace must be made to produce good works. We have to be alert and committed to such an extent that the Lord may see, at his coming, that his generosity has been responded to by the generosity of man.
In a similar parable recounted by St. Luke, the lesson, we're told, is the same, to bring to fruit the divine gift received. But let's look at our more earthly interpretation of that word talent, and hear what some of our writers have had to say on the subject. It was Conan Doyle, the inventor of Sherlock Holmes, no less, who made this surprising statement.
Mediocrity knows nothing higher than itself, but talent instantly recognizes genius.
While a little-known poet, Owen Meredith, wrote rather cleverly, "Genius does what it must, and talent does what it can." Swift, in his usual caustic style, commented that it's the talent of human nature to run from one extreme to another. And a few decades earlier, Dryden declared in a poetic prologue,
"But 'tis the talent of the English nation still to be plotting some new reformation."
In the 19th century, a humorous poet called Praed wrote these lines.
"Of science and logic he chatters, as fine and as fast as he can, though I am no judge of such matters, I'm sure he's a talented man."
In 1806, an ironical name was given to a coalition government formed by a certain Lord Grenville. But the Ministry of All the Talents, which we're told was an attempt at a broadly based administration, consisted largely of the followers of the Foreign Secretary, Charles James Fox. But it achieved one great thing, which may be said to have redeemed its reputation, the abolition of the slave trade. If we must be hard-working in developing the spiritual gifts, Surely the same attitude should apply to the temporal ones. As the portrait painter Sir Joshua Reynolds said in his discourse to students of the Royal Academy in the December of 1769.
If you have great talents, industry will improve them. If you have but moderate abilities, industry will supply their deficiency.
Reynolds was a contemporary and close friend of Dr. Samuel Johnson, the great conversationalist and compiler of a famous dictionary. James Boswell, who wrote his biography, quotes a curious verse written on the death of a dear friend of Johnson's.
His virtues walked their narrow round, nor made a pause, nor left a void, and sure the eternal master found his single talent well employed.
That Boswell was somewhat mystified at Johnson's affection for an undistinguished doctor of medicine is clear from his earliest reference to the man.
His humble friend, Mr. Robert Levitt, an obscure practicer in physic amongst the lower people, his fees being sometimes very small sums, sometimes whatever provisions his patients could afford him. He was of a strange, grotesque appearance, stiff and formal in his manner, and seldom said a word while any company was present. Such was Johnson's predilection for him, and fanciful estimation of his moderate abilities, that I have heard him say he should not be satisfied, though attended by all the College of Physicians, unless he had Mr. Levitt with him.
Boswell may well have been puzzled, but perhaps the less perceptive eye of his talent missed what the sharper vision of Johnson's genius had recognised. That here was a man who had indeed put his one gift to full use, and to the service of others, indeed to our Lord's chosen ones, the poor. On a more down-to-earth level are the opening words of a song by Noel Coward, which ran, "I believe that since my life began, the most I've had is just a talent to amuse." And that talent he exploited to the full, and to his autobiography gave the title, "A Talent to Amuse." But when a talent is rendered unusable, what then? For John Milton, the loss of his sight seemed at first a veritable disaster. But being a reflective, religious man, he came to terms with it, as we hear in this sonnet, on his blindness.
When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent, which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my Maker, and present my true account, lest he returning chide, doth God exact day labour, light denied? I fondly ask. But patience, to prevent that murmur, soon replies, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly, thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait.
The gift which it was death to hide was that of the writer, and despite his blindness, Milton continued to write. If he hadn't, there would have been no Paradise Lost, for his epic poem was dictated. Had he lived today, the marvels of medicine would have enabled him to see his work in print. But he was writing in the 17th century, and his contemporary, Samuel Pepys, suffered a similar fate. This is part of the last entry in his famous diary, written in his own hand.
May 31st, 1669. And thus ends all that I doubt I shall ever be able to do with my own eyes in the keeping of my journal. I being not able to do it any longer, having done now so long as to undo my eyes almost every time that I take a pen in my hand. And therefore, whatever comes of it, I must forbear, and therefore resolve from this time forward to have it kept by my people in longhand, and must be contented to set down no more than is fit for them and all the world to know. or if there be anything, I must endeavour to keep a margin in my book open to add here and there a note in shorthand with my own hand.
I wonder what kind of shorthand Pepys used. Not only blindness, but deafness too has taken its victims. Witness Beethoven, and yet he continued to compose, giving the world his Ninth Symphony and other works. And if men of genius have struggled to the end with these handicaps, to use their gifts to the full, what more need we say? The last word belongs, surely, to the apostles. Paul wrote to both the Romans and the Corinthians on the subject of the gifts received. To the Romans, he said,
"In the light of the grace I have received, I want to urge each one among you not to exaggerate his real importance. Each of you must judge himself soberly by the standard of the faith. God has given him, just as each of our bodies has several parts and each part has a separate function, so all of us, in union with Christ, form one body, and as parts of it we belong to each other. Our gifts differ according to the grace given us. If your gift is prophecy, then use it as your faith suggests. If administration, then use it for administration. If teaching, then use it for teaching. Let the preachers deliver sermons, the almsgivers give freely, the officials be diligent, and those who do works of mercy, do them cheerfully."
To the Corinthians, Paul wrote of the variety and unity of gifts.
"There's a variety of gifts, but always the same Spirit. There are all sorts of service to be done, but always to the same Lord. Working in all sorts of different ways, in different people, it is the same God who is working in all of them. The particular way in which the Spirit is given to each person is for a good purpose. One may have the gift of preaching with wisdom, given him by the Spirit. Another may have the gift of preaching instruction, given him by the same Spirit. And another the gift of faith, given by the same Spirit. Another a gift of healing through this one Spirit. One the power of miracles, another prophecy, another the gift of recognizing spirits, another the gift of tongues, and another the ability to interpret them. All these are the work of one and the same Spirit, who distributes different gifts to different people, just as he chooses."
And we cannot do better than to close with these words of St. Peter in his first letter to Christian churches.
"Each one of you has received a special grace. So, like good stewards responsible for all these different graces of God, put yourselves at the service of others. If you are a speaker, speak in words which seem to come from God. If you are a helper, help as though every action was done at God's orders, so that in everything God may receive the glory through Jesus Christ, since to him alone belong all glory and power, forever and ever. Amen."
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that programme. And now our friend and Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, who's host of EWTN's Joan's Rome show, takes us back over the past week's events here in the Vatican.
OK, Joan, so here we are once again, and we're all ready for your weekly roundup of Vatican News.
And a lot of it, but as usual, we're kind of limited to just the top stories, and there's so many of those every week. But we will begin our weekly report with a look back at the Angelus on Sunday. Of course, the main message was that charity fuels faith, making it fruitful and credible. And the Holy Father said that this, what we've just said, is not sufficient to lead a life of faith. A Christian must be fueled by charity. And of course, he was then made reference to the parable of the 10 virgins. And he said, one must not wait for, quote, the last minute of our lives to collaborate with God's grace. You must do it now. And then he was quoting from the liturgical reading in which the Lord said to the virgins, stay awake, for you know neither the day nor the hour. And so he explained that Jesus is telling us to stay awake, but this doesn't mean only not to fall asleep. It's an exhortation to be prepared. So he said the lamp, speaking of the lamps of the virgins, those who were prepared and those who weren't and ran out of oil, the Holy Father said the lamp is the symbol of faith that illuminates our lives, and oil is the symbol of charity which fuels the lamp, making the light of faith fruitful and credible. And he said, a life that is poor in charity is devoid of true light. So very beautiful words on that gospel. I think all of us have heard it so many times, but the Pope gives us a new way of looking at it. And then, by the way, at the end of the Angelus, after praying the Angelus with the faithful, the Pope remarked on the beatification ceremony that took place in Madrid on Saturday and talked about the new Spanish martyrs who were killed for their faith during the religious persecution that took place during the 1936-1937 Spanish Civil War. So more martyrs in the church, more saints. And then we move to Wednesday, as we often do, and this is such a fascinating new catechesis that the Pope has started on the Holy Mass. And he said the Mass is a prayer. Rather, it's the prayer par excellence, the highest, the most sublime, and at the same time the most concrete, because it's an encounter with the Lord. What is prayer really, said Francis? It's first of all a dialogue, a relationship with God. Man was created as a being in personal relationship with God, who finds his full realization only in the encounter with the Creator. And that dialogue, the Pope just mentioned, he said, it also means knowing how to remain silent in the presence of the other. And then in some very interesting words, he said, in this sense, we must be like children, able to entrust ourselves entirely to God as children do with their parents. And, like children, he said, we must also have a sense of wonder. We must allow ourselves to be surprised. When we speak to God in prayer, the Pope said, it's not talking to God like parrots. Instead, it means entrusting ourselves and opening our hearts to allow ourselves to wonder. The encounter with God in Mass is always a living encounter. It is not a meeting in a museum. So he always gives us a lot to reflect on, doesn't he, the Holy Father, when he, a homily or Angelus.
And wonderful metaphors.
Or what? Yes, wonderful metaphors. You really can picture so much of what he's saying. And now, interestingly enough, at Wednesday's audience.
This is a cute story.
This was probably the headline story around the world, actually. The Holy Father was given a Lamborghini to be auctioned off for charity. And it's a very high-end car, just under $200,000. The car was white with some spots of yellow, yellow and white being the Vatican colors. And the Holy Father actually signed the car. So this is
going to. Blessed it.
Yes. And, of course, blessed it. And it's going to be auctioned off by Sotheby's in London, the proceeds given to four charities in the Pope's name. And those are, proceeds will go to the papal charity, very well known around the world, Aid to the Church in Need. That's going to go towards rebuilding homes, churches, and public buildings in Iraq's Nineveh Plains. And this will help the Christians who had taken refuge in Iraqi Kurdistan to finally return to their roots roots and recover their dignity. And then a second recipient, there were four, of the of the Lamborghini's proceeds will be the John 23rd Community, offers protection and aid for women who have been victims of human trafficking and prostitution. And then two Italian charities, one is called GCOM and the other Friends of Central Africa. So they will also receive some of the funds from that Lamborghini. That's a wonderful gesture on the Holy Father's part, but it's also a wonderful gesture on Lamborghini's part. Obviously, a little bit of publicity, but still a wonderful gesture.
Indeed. I think it's a win-win for all.
Oh, exactly. Perfectly described. So then we move on to Thursday, and the Holy Father sent a letter to participants in the European regional meeting of the World Medical Association on end-of-life issues. And, of course, they're looking at the new challenges that arise with regard to end-of-life issues, and that's obviously what the Holy Father highlighted in this message. And he said, "The anguish associated with conditions that bring us to the threshold of human mortality and the difficulty of the decision we have to make may tempt us to step back from the patient. Yet this is where, more than anything else, we are called to show love and closeness, recognizing the limit we all share and showing our solidarity." Now, in his message, the Holy Father called for a greater wisdom in striking a balance between medical efforts to prolong life and the responsible decision to withhold treatment when death becomes inevitable. But again, as always, the human person, in this case a patient, is at the center of the Holy Father's focus.
Especially the most vulnerable, as
exactly,
you said it.
Exactly, and always. And then, oh, another wonderful event on Thursday. Pope Francis made a surprise visit to a field hospital in St. Peter's Square. Now, this field hospital is run by the Italian Red Cross, and it was set up in St. Peter's Square to provide medical care for Rome's poor. The Pope, it was just a short visit. He greeted the volunteers and those people waiting to receive care ahead of Sunday celebration, of course, of the first World Day of the Poor.
And this is, in fact, tied very much
absolutely
to that event.
It's all part of it. This was organized, of course, by the Pontifical Council for Promoting the New Evangelization. Archbishop Rino Fisichella, who heads that council, was with the Holy Father. And again, this is one of the structures, one of the initiatives set up by the council for this particular day, this World Day of the Poor. And yet again, on Thursday, we still had more news from the Holy Father, right. And it was another letter, actually, to participants in the COP23 UN Convention on Climate Change. And this is a meeting taking place in Bonn, Germany, quite a lengthy one, from November 6th to the 17th. And the letter was actually addressed to the Prime Minister of the Fiji Islands because they are officially hosting the event. And the Pope renewed his urgent call for renewed dialogue on how we're building the future of the planet. He said, "We need an exchange that unites us all because the environmental challenge we are experiencing and its human roots regards all of us and affects us all." But he warned participants not to fall into what he called four perverse attitudes regarding the future of the planet, and that is to say denial, indifference, resignation, and trust in inadequate solutions. Friday, we saw a wonderful video message from Pope Francis to the people of Myanmar for his upcoming visit. In fact, his apostolic journey to Myanmar will be from November 27th to the 30th. He said in that message, "I'm coming to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, a message of reconciliation, forgiveness, and peace." And he said, "My visit is meant to confirm the Catholic community in Myanmar of its worship of God and its witness to the gospel." Pope Francis said the gospel, quote, "teaches the dignity of every man and woman and commands us to open our hearts to others, especially the poor and those in need."
Thank you very much, Joan, once again, for giving us that roundup.
And I was speaking there to Joan Lewis, host of EWTN's Joan's Rome Show. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.